There are no quick and easy solutions to our personal problems. A teenage marriage does not make one mature overnight. A significant legacy does not lighten our lives with a sense of purpose nor give us peace of mind. And what is true of our private problems is infinitely more true of the complex of problems which face us on the domestic and then the social scene. Many of us have been impressed these past months and years with the number and variety of programs and laws which have been enacted to free the poor from his poverty and free the Negro from his disability. I wonder if you will be shocked to know that if we continue these present programs of welfare and anti-discrimination at their present rate of cost and expenditure over the next 25 years, we will succeed in limiting the increase of poverty and discrimination to twice its present figure. If by some miracle we could provide to the public schools every dollar which they say they require, and at the same time erase all the disadvantages of slum living, of underprivileged and undercultured homes, it would still, we are told, require us 75 years to close the gap between the disparity in the learning abilities of the white students and those of the Negro students. There are no easy solutions to the twin problems of race and poverty. And yet we would like to delude ourselves that by the stroke of the president's pen, by a Voting Rights Act, by civil rights legislation, by a fair housing ordinance, by Fair Employment Practice Commissions, by such legislation, simply and cleanly and easily, we would have achieved the goal of equal opportunity for all, which lies at the basis of our national conscience. Now, such laws were urgent. Better laws are urgent. The fuller implementation of existing laws and administrative procedures is urgent. But when all is said and done, the nation requires far more than a few bits of federal legislation in order to bring the sunlight of opportunity into the shadow world of delinquency and discrimination and deterioration and despair in which the Negro poor drag out their lives. It's time that you and I faced up to the urgency, to the complexity, and to the magnitude of the problem which confronts us. When 3 weeks ago the United States Civil Rights Commission held its much publicized hearings in our city, the paper which was prepared by its staff for submission to the commission on the area of education stated flat out that there is a widespread disparity between the learning potential of the Negro and the white student at the beginning of their public school education, and that this disparity widens, the gap enlarges in each subsequent year of their education. Now, some of the problems which have created this disparity we have recognized and we have taken steps to meet. Construction can overcome the problem of overcrowding in the classroom. Better financing can raise the level of pay of the teacher staff and bring better teachers into the school system. Recognition of the motivational needs of the lower classes in our society can create new curriculum. But what shall we do about that congeries of social and demographic and family problems, the pathology of the slum, which affects the education of these young people, which retards the education of these young people? How shall we do away with the confusion of the southern rural in-migrant class who do not understand the city and who have no comprehension of the purposes of education? How shall we overcome their understandable psychological fear of losing their child by his walking through the ladder of education into a new level of life, into a new world? In their poverty, how shall we quiet their fears that during the years of his education they will lose his needed paycheck? How shall we combat the influence of the peer group, the ever-enlarging group of those who have been confused and disconcerted by our public school systems, who crowd on the sidewalks, who jeer those who continue because they themselves were prevented from understanding, from taking advantage of education? How shall we overcome the disadvantage of there not being a father figure in the home, a man? How shall we overcome the disadvantage of there being sinister men figures lurking in the alleys as the child walks to the streets? And how shall we overcome the disability of a curriculum and of a program which prepares the young person for a world or a job market which no longer exists? The facts are clear, tragically clear. In our city, 6.9% of all the Negro youngsters enrolled in our Cleveland public school system end their education at the end of the junior high school. And during each of the three subsequent years of high school, 14.6% drop out. One in two of the Negro children never receive their high school diploma, the minimum level of achievement we assume to be necessary to enter the job market in the 1960s. But more tragic still, of those who manage to graduate high school in the Hough area and the central planning areas and the like, of that one in two who somehow persevered, those who graduated in June of 1965, 11 months ago, 50% of these are still today walking aimlessly the sidewalks of our city, unable to get a job, prepared neither for college nor for employment. We are simply not doing what needs to be done by and for these young people. Education is opportunity, but it's a promise on which we haven't made good. The door is slightly ajar, but it's not wide open. We ought to recognize and admit this tragic fact. A slum is not simply a building. It's a way of life. It's what has been called a closed society. Closed because by and large the uneducated or undereducated parent will sire an undereducated child. The underemployed parent will sire an underemployed child. There's almost no way for the child to break free, to break out of the social pathology of the slum, to receive the training, the education, the skills required to move into the middle class, to move into the job market, to breathe the air of opportunity on which this nation prides itself. And if we do not break the closed society of the slum in this generation, the children in our schools today will in their turn sire undereducated and underemployed youngsters who will suffer the coarseness and the vulgarity, inevitably build up the antisocial tendencies which are found in the gray and dismal areas of the city. Legislation is not enough. There are no simple solutions to these vast human problems. Fair housing ordinances are good and necessary. But of what use are they if there is no low-cost housing available outside of the crowded Negro areas of the city? And in Cleveland, there is pathetically little of such housing available. In fact, each of the last few years, 300 housing units for low-cost housing units have been withdrawn from the market, demolished or done away with. Instead of adding to the housing pool at a time of rising population, we have subtracted from it. Of what use are fair housing ordinances if the Negro has not the wherewithal to pay the rent? What use is it if we do not confront this simple, classic, terrible problem? The Negro is concentrated in the lowest skilled areas of the society. He's the blue-collar worker. He's the clerical worker. What are the areas of society which are going to suffer most from the cybernetic and the computer revolution? The blue-collar worker, the clerical worker. Not only does he have three times the level of unemployment today that the white society has, but he faces in the next 10 or 20 years vast employment upheaval. He lacks the skills to allow him to be flexible, to find new jobs, and to make new contacts. Of what use is fair employment practices, commissions, and regulations if the Negro coming out of the public schools lacks the skills with which to be hired in the first place? And if we allow the unions, especially the construction unions and the craft unions, to devise a whole series of artful contrivances which prevent the Negro from receiving that union certificate, union membership, which allows him to be on the job in the first place. We face, I am afraid, a congeery, a complex of problems, each of which must be attacked at the same time. If we propose honestly to do the moral and the constitutional thing, to break open the slum, to break open the society of the underprivileged, and to bring them into the ambit of opportunity of the most affluent and blessed society in the world. During the Civil Rights Commission hearings, Father Theodore Hesburgh, the president of Notre Dame University and a member of the commission, visited some of the 7,000 apartment units which lack certificates of occupancy. The apartments are rented, and rented at good cost. But they lack the certificate that these apartments are fit for human dwelling. And after he had visited some of these multiple family units, as they're called, we used to call them tenements, he made this simple and succinct observation. I have seen better pig pens. Now, slums are no shock to the city dweller. Slums have been part of the city since time immemorial. So perhaps Cleveland wasn't shocked. But perhaps we were by the rather offhanded comment made before the commission that the Huff area is perhaps the classic, the grayest human cesspool, the grayest slum in these whole United States. And if we weren't shocked by this testimony, at least we were shocked by the admission that in this Huff area, these last 3 years, housing inspectors pledged to carry out the housing codes of our city have simply not been on the job. When asked why, the acting urban renewal director of our city observed that in the previous administration of his department, it had been decided not to investigate the apartments in this area because this was to be an urban renewal area. And if at some future date the city wanted to acquire this land, and if now the landowner had in fact upgraded, renewed, rehabilitated his apartment, a higher acquisition price might have to be paid. Between the budget and its poor, Cleveland chose the budget. One city housing inspector could never remember having closed an apartment simply because it was unfit for human habitation. And one public health inspector of our national government made the observation that, yes, Cleveland was the best location in the nation for rats. I always associated rats with Middle Ages, the bubonic plague and the Black Death. And I had assumed naively that in the 20th century we had sanitation departments and effective garbage collection, and that we had solved this problem. But apparently in Cleveland, we have not. We are careless with our hygiene. We are careless with the public health. At least we are careless in those areas of the city which we drive around and not through, which are studied by sociologists but not seen by the citizens. The Civil Rights Commission made a searching and searing investigation of our city. If we were to sum up its results, Cleveland stands guilty, as does probably every other major northern city, of shocking indifference, callousness, short-sightedness, lack of political courage, and certainly lack of vision. We have preferred raising the slums to raising the standard of living of those who are now in the slums. Demolition to human decency. One of the most unbelievable bits of testimony before the Civil Rights Commission was this exchange, questioned by the counsel of the commission. What has Cleveland done to increase adequate Negro housing? Answer by the acting director of urban renewal. Nothing that I know of, sir. When we went in to raise St. Vincent's and Area A and Area B and elements in the central area of our city for urban renewal, we uprooted the Negro. What did we do with him? We dumped him right back into heavily congested Negro areas elsewhere in the city. Cleveland has not been building relocation housing. That public housing which we have built is largely for the elderly, and when it includes larger family units, much of this housing has been built precisely in those largely white or largely Negro areas, and by some administrative procedure which was not fully explained to the commission, our public housing estates reflect almost exactly the demographic, the racial composition of the areas in which they are found. On the east side, they are Negro. On the west side, they are white. 9 times as many Negroes as whites wait for admission to the public housing units. But on the west side, we have public housing estates which are entirely white. And apparently no effort has been made to introduce Negro families into these units. Cleveland has not made available to its citizens public housing, federal housing monies available for building relocation units. They have not used construction intelligently, placing the units that they build in areas which are fairly integrated or fairly stable. Rather, we have compounded the problem of racial segregation by what such building has gone on. We have raised land for institutions. We have not raised buildings for our people. It's a tragic, tragic statement. Political short-sightedness. as the urban renewal program and the public housing program were designed not only to revitalize the city, but to rehabilitate the decency of those who live in the city. And this latter goal seems entirely to have been forgotten. What is true of housing is true of health. It's shocking to know, isn't it, that Cleveland is the metropolitan area which spends the least on public health. This affects all of us. Cleveland has no chronic disease control, no public mental health program, no epidemiological investigation. This affects all of us, but affects the Negro the more. Our nursing caseloads in the public health centers are far too high all over the city. But they range from 303 per nurse per month on the west side to 866 in the central and Hough areas of our city. The results, they're clear. Negro births represent 28.9% of all births in the city. The death of Negro mothers represent 60% of all deaths. Infant death among Negroes is 44% of the total. Stillborn deaths, 40% of the whole. Not only are they poor and underprivileged, but such services as we present are unequally distributed among our population. What is true of housing and true of health is true of welfare. 2.8% of our white population is unemployed, 8.9% of our Negro population. And what is the level of aid available through public welfare and public assistance and the aid to dependent children? In 1959, the federal government established a standard of minimum subsistence. Cleveland today is giving to a poor family of four 72% of that 1959 standard, or approximately 60% of what a family needs to survive on gruel and cold food. There was one bit of pathos at these hearings. A little child, a boy, about 8 or 9, accompanied his mother, who testified about the rats and about the clogged plumbing and about the illicit activities which were going on in the custodian's apartment. And one of the commissioners turned to the boy and he said, "What does mother serve you during that last 2 weeks of the month when there's very little money around?" And he said, "I live on oatmeal and rice. Are you ever hungry?" "Sometimes." This in the best location in the nation, in the most abundant nation in our world. I could give you much more of the same from the investigations which preceded the commission and by the commission hearings itself, but need more be said. The picture is one of indifference, of callousness, of short-sightedness, of timidity, leaderlessness, and sometimes of worse. Cleveland, I am afraid, preferred to accentuate the positive. On the last day of the commission, Clevelanders who had been active in the areas of welfare and of civil rights appeared and they testified as to what had been accomplished. Operation Head Start, the Ludlow area, elimination of kindergarten waiting lists, the Plans for Progress program, which has brought open employment in some 89 of our major plants, the Fair Housing Incorporated, the movement of some Negroes into East Cleveland and into the eastern suburbs, the manpower development programs, the Job Corps, all these and more. Men spoke and women spoke of the tutorial program, of volunteer programs, such things as our John Hay and Charles Orr and Springbrook programs here at the Temple. And we had a sense of pride. Perhaps, well, we should, at least that small minority among us who have been active in these programs. But I think Cleveland must recognize that however valid all these programs are, they represent only a ripple in a sea of turmoil, only a slight undulation in a vast ocean of need. We require a tidal wave of change. Cleveland requires vision, a vision far beyond the experimentation, the small bore programs which we have devised so far. We are part of a sweeping social revolution. And unless you and I recognize this fact and plan accordingly, this revolution will surge eventually over us in violence of the Watts type and an unplanned social change which can be of no virtue and use to anyone. We need to attack poverty. We need to attack prejudice. We need to attack the indifference of our police to those who live in the central areas. We need to attack the complicated problems of education. We need to provide housing. We need to provide jobs. We need to provide job opportunity and job training and job retraining. We need to provide a school environment which will be open from dawn to dusk, so that the home environment will not be the only bleakness that the child knows. We need to provide the smallest child with adults whom they can mimic, from whom they can learn language, simple speech. We need to provide the growing up child with those who have the patience and the time to listen, to give them the example of competent adults living in the century. Cleveland needs so much. I've tried to capsule what I think is required of us in a mnemonic. Often I hear conversation of this and that which Cleveland needs. We tend to forget it as soon as it is said. Well, I've tried to build what Cleveland needs around the word rights. R stands in my mind for respect. Respect for political activity. Respect for picketing. Respect for placards. Respect for political disturbance on our streets when it is designed to correct existing evils. Because if there is one thing that this commission has shown, it is this: that Cleveland prefers to sweep its dirt into the carpet of the slums. Out of sight is out of mind. Unless there are screaming headlines, we prefer inaction to action, lethargy to planning. Protest is the catalyst of change in this city, or it is at least at this moment in our history. And until we show a willingness to confront the 20th century, to confront the 255,000 Negroes of our city and the 100,000 more who are poor, until we show the vision, the political vision, to confront these problems realistically, we must have respect for that which disturbs law and order, for that which roils the social order, however difficult that is for many of us. R is for respect, I is for intelligence. We've had enough of putting together little programs to solve this or that small program, small need. We need the intelligence to see the whole range of problems which confront us, and to devise a broad-based program using our own tax monies and federal monies and state monies to attack the housing and the welfare and the discrimination problems which confront us. We cannot any longer blink at reality. We need the intelligence to confront this century and not the last, and to put behind us all those old shibboleths: where there's a will, there's a way. Every man has his place. If there's a job, there man wants to work, he can always find work. Put all that behind us and recognize this violent age of social revolution, of technological revolution, of political revolution for what it is. To recognize the closed society for the imprisonment that it is. And to recognize that we can parole people from that society only by shattering it, by bringing sunlight into it. R is for respect, I is for intelligence, G is for generosity. Between human need and the taxes which must pay for this need, we must choose taxes. Between spending our time fully in our leisure, and spending our time in activities of social concern, we must choose a measure of social concern. It continues to amaze me that there are people who complain to me week in and week out, I don't know what to do with myself. In a society which cries out for volunteers, for people who will meet people, get to know them, give them the example of an adult, tutor them in their own language, tutor them in the basic skills that human beings require. R is for respect, I is for intelligence, G is for generosity, H is for humanity. Between bricks and people, we must choose people. Between demolition and decency, we must choose decency. Between raising the slums and raising the standard of living, the standard of opportunity of those in the slums, we must raise their standard of living. Our headlines are filled with new buildings, new schools, new universities, new centers for this or that activity or institution. Let's begin to fill our headlines with the work of human salvage, with this child whom we began to work with at the age of 3, and who nursery schools and operations Head Starts and enriched school programs, and by acting as volunteer scout directors and cub masters and group workers and settlement house workers, we surrounded with a home, with a family, until he graduated into the larger world. Let's speak of that world. And let's find a time when those who win merit scholarships in our city, whose wonderful pictures filled the newspapers last week, include one, at least, Negro child. 2, 3. There wasn't a one among them. R is for respect. I is for intelligence. G is for generosity. H is for humanity. T is for a total solution, totality. We have a way of saying, this is Cleveland's problem. I live in Shaker Heights. This is the city's problem. I live in Pepper Pike or Cleveland Heights or South Euclid. Metropolitan planning. Segregation, which is an evil in itself, will exist as long as Cleveland alone must solve the problems of open occupancy. Segregation in the classroom will exist as long as there is one public school system in our city, 2 dozen others in the county. When we build school buildings, let's begin to build buildings which can draw students from all over the area. When we build our institutions, let's place them at such a place that they will draw white and Negro, upper class and lower class and middle class, provide an environment which will be enriching to all. Cleveland needs to break out of the 19th century vice, which has given us 104 governing units, 32 school districts, and create a truly metropolitan sense of community. R is for respect, I is for intelligence, G is for generosity, H is for humanity, T is for totality, and S is for steadfastness. For it seems to me that it is a simple observation that this problem will be with us throughout our lifetime and throughout the lifetime of our children and of our children's children. And that the sunshine soldiers, those who believe that the problem will be over with one victory, will not be equal to the struggle which is before us. The war on poverty and the war on race are a century-long commitment, a commitment to a new structure of society, a commitment to a new philosophy of society, which emphasizes planning and concern and welfare and humanity rather than property rights and the traditional concerns of the laissez-faire society of the past. Men have spoken of what they call the ordeal of change, but none of us doubt that the changes which face us in America will be of the nature of an ordeal. There will be violence, there will be abrasion, there will be hate, there will be fear, there will be flight. The ordeal of change, we have seen it already, and we will see more of it. To keep one's head and to keep one's sense of purpose throughout this ordeal is the mark of the man. It's the mark of the citizen. It is the challenge which confronts us at this moment in our time. When Cleveland's record was totaled up by the United States Civil Rights Commission, let us confess it, it made sorry reading. We are a timid city. We are a smug city. We're a self-satisfied city. We're a leaderless city. We're a city which is shackled by ancient forms of government. We have a city where our best minds have preferred welfare than politics. We're a city which needs to be shaken awake. I do not care how we will compare with this city or that. I care only that Cleveland be a city with a heart. That Cleveland be a city fit to live in for the majority, for the totality of its citizenship. And if we continue at our present poking along rate, muddling through, taking little steps in an age which requires giant steps, the problems will become more aggravated and not less. For the solutions which we have attempted so far are palliative rather than structural. And so I pray for the city which I love. Vision, steadfastness, courage, determination. I pray for us, for we are the city. The willingness to give, vision. Be courageous and to be steadfast, and most of all, to be adequate to the overwhelming and overriding responsibilities of citizenship.